Thank you very much, and thank you, Paul. It's an honor and a privilege to be invited to give the J.J. Thiessen Lectures at CMU, my alma mater. You know, when you invite an alumnus back to give lectures 33 years after his graduation, virtually a messianic lifetime, that he's going to have a lot to say. Now, not to say that this is a messianic moment, but it might be. That's up to you. But it is the case that I have way too much to say. But Paul has told me how long I've got in each session. And I hope that this means more that something about the fullness of my heart than that I'm going to be long-winded. But I'm going to allow you to be judge of that too. I want, however, to move right into this talk because it's fairly wide-ranging. I begin with some reflections on the erotics of mammon. In an article in the New York Times this summer entitled "She Can Play That Game Too," the journalist Kate Taylor explored the growing edge of on-campus hookup culture, focusing on women in particular who don't have time for dating and its emotional entanglements. "It's like taking a four-credit course," said one woman, "and gets in the way of my getting a competitive edge." And by that, she means grades, contacts, leadership profile, internships, and other credentials important for landing a good corporate job. Another interviewee said she's not regretted any of her many one-night stands, but doesn't want her name identified or the number of her trysts published because, and I quote, 10 years from now, no one will remember, I will not remember, who I have slept with. But I will remember, like my transcript, because it's still there, in the data bank, I assume, not the love bank. I will remember what I did. Apparently, having sex is not doing anything much. I will remember my accomplishments and places my name is hung on campus. End of quote. In the same issue, a 35-year-old grad student in New York City says that what mayoral candidates Elliot Spitzer and Anthony Weiner did, one consorting with prostitutes, the other sexting young women across the country, makes no real difference. It doesn't mean anything to me, she says. That's something personal. What these stories suggest is a process of having our lives turned inside out. The intimately personal is literally inconsequential. What really matters is our jobs and public accomplishments. What has happened here is not least an economic matter. We value to the point of blind slavery an externalized, anonymous, and corporate understanding of person. The women interviewed in these articles have done a cost-benefit analysis of their dating lives and explicitly use corporate economic language for it. Low risk and low investment costs, trading up and trading down. As we know, this is not simply a matter of idiosyncratic individual choice. In the same issue of the Times, I read that China is relocating 250 million people from subsistence agricultural traditional villages in beautiful remote regions into ugly newly built high-rises in anonymous cities. Why? As the communist government says overtly, so they will become consumers and help build a global corporate Chinese economy. That is the new meaning of meaningful citizenship, and as a form of political economic integration, it will entail a complete reorientation and re-education of desire. It is necessary to push 700 million rural Chinese into the 21st century in the name of economic progress. The new prime minister states, "An objective rule in the process of modernization is we have to complete the process of urbanization and industrialization, a rule already established in the empire economics of 19th century Britain and 20th century North America." The unspoken rationale, though creating consumers is vulgar enough, is the unhindered development of resource extraction economy in the nether regions, with which we here in Canada are familiar enough. Mining, forestry, and damming remote rivers for power will support the high-dependency, de-skilled lifestyles of the new working poor who are being displaced, only, as the report tells us, to have them unable to afford the power in their newly built high-rises, where they rely on outdoor fires to do their cooking and are pulling their children from schools to work in low-level jobs. Thus do we continue to put the pedal to the metal in a global economic juggernaut careening wildly toward the abysmal cliff of climate change, which will make our planet increasingly uninhabitable for flesh and blood creatures who used to be called persons. I want to examine this language of person briefly. For a long time, it was a term with theological significance. Person, along with language of incorporation or embodiment, incarnation, has been increasingly transferred to the economic realm of capitalist agency. The capitalist corporation was made a person through legal fiction in the 20th century, in the expansion of the legal rights of that personhood, even beyond national and political borders, has been nothing short of stunning. We'll return to that. For now, I want to focus on some of the kinds of corporate slavery that are tied to the financial and legal structure of corporate governance, a governance that increasingly orients and dominates our personal lives, from places of work to educational institutions, to entertainment and sports industries, to food, pleasure, and health industries, to churches and religious institutions. Indeed, even marriage has increasingly come to be seen in the contractual terms of a financial partnership as the primary metaphor of what we are doing legally and personally when we get married. I'm going to quote Wendell Berry. "Marriage, in what is evidently its most popular form, is now, on the one hand, an intimate relationship involving ideally two successful careerists in the same bed, and on the other hand, a sort of private political system in which rights and interests must be constantly asserted and defended. Marriage, in other words, has now taken the form of divorce, a prolonged and impassioned negotiation as to how things shall be divided. During their understandably temporary association, the married couple will typically consume a large quantity of merchandise and a large portion of each other." The cost-benefit calculations of the young women in campus hookup culture have not come out of the blue. One of the popular slogans on my campus says, "Sex work is real work," which is tied to these same progressivist economic assumptions in which personal agency has been corporatized, not by becoming more embodied, as the word corporate originally signified, but more abstract, hollowed out, and governed by money and property relations. It turns out Soren Kierkegaard saw something about our own time when he said, in his book called The Present Age in the 19th century, that money is the most abstract kind of representation, and that our ennui, our lack of passion, stems from the transformation of passion into money, capital, which alone comes to be desired, the abstract currency of envy that hollows out and blinkers our vision of the created world. With all of this come the attendant anxieties, because as we know, things are obviously not getting more secure in a growth-based innovation economy where power is rapidly being concentrated at the top, as always happens in empires devoted to mammon. What happens when the mystical body of corporations expands exponentially through legal fiction? Increasingly, forms of corporate slavery where employees are seen as the properties of these inhuman persons, whose rights, freedoms, and powers have been radically expanded to include invasive surveillance, summary dismissal, rampant border crossing that undercuts local and community responsibility, a decline in minimal wage vis-a-vis inflation, the replacement of full-time by part-time workers without benefits, the growing pay packages of CEOs vis-a-vis the declining income of lower-level employees. I'll give you one representative anecdote taken from my background in some ways. Caterpillar pioneered a two-tier wage system recently, where workers hired later were consigned to a lower wage scale and recently pressed longer-term employees to accept a 6-year wage freeze, even while the corporation reported record profits. And Cat CEO, whose pay had increased 80% over the past 2 years, argued that the freeze was necessary to stay competitive, and I quote, "I always try to communicate to our people that we can never make enough money," he said recently to Bloomberg Businessweek. "We can never make enough profit." So we have growing corporate concentrations of wealth in a plutocratic elite who can't ever make enough money. And of course, our political systems are increasingly dependent upon and subservient to the interests of corporate personhood. In the United States, corporate donations to political parties and candidates are now legally considered to be not buying elections or influencing them, but literally exercising free speech. My point is not to provide a political economic analysis here. That would require a lot more time. But I am painting in broad brushstrokes so as to move toward a theological account of some of it, an account that will have to pay close attention to Kierkegaard's point about human passion being translated into monetary abstraction, that will have to pay attention to the question of desire. The alternative to serving the empire of mammon is to attend to alternative principles of governance in terms of alternative accounts of human agency, motivation, and sovereignty. Kenneth Burke points out that the book of Genesis is a statement of logical firsts or principles in the cosmic ordering of creation that governs reality. We might note, first of all, that this ordering account is not scientific or quantitative, but dramatic. God created not only the things of nature, but a dramatic setting for the divine human drama. Creation is also a covenant between God, human beings, and the whole created order, understood dramatistically. It's not accidental that the original Latin meaning of the word person is to sound through a character mask in the ancient theater. It's a dramatic word related to a dramatic setting. And the Greek equivalent, prosopon, means face, the public manifestation, the optics of a person's character and emotions, which has its own rich web of biblical and theological associations. Above all, it suggests a who and not a what, which affects how we represent and treat the identity and agency of persons. According to Genesis, humans are made in God's image, and God is not to be represented in any visible form. Such representations constitute idolatry, the vain presumption that human beings could possibly know God well enough to represent God's character. Such presumptive knowledge also implicitly claims a kind of control or power that is dangerous to and destructive of proper human agency. This doesn't preclude the personal love of God being experienced, as depicted in the case of Moses and Jacob as face-to-face relationships. On the contrary, it makes that personal and intimate relation all the more holy and mysterious, beyond direct representation. I expect this is a major theological reason why Mennonites up to my great-grandparents' generation in the 20th century, and present-day Amish still, were not in favor of having their photos taken. The human being fashioned in the divine image was not to be represented externally, as such captured representations express vain knowledge and indeed a kind of erotic violation. Related to this is the veiling of women, so offensive to morbid secularists of our own time. Ultimately, I think it's related to our attitudes towards human nudity and clothing. Not unrelated to this point, and I mention it in passing because it pertains to our topic, the political economy question, is God's anger at David in taking a census of the people. Census taking is related in Exodus 30 to a redemption offering to God in an economy of divine human atonement for sin, whereas David wants to count the people for ostensibly military purposes, and it bespeaks a presumptive form of human control, a measuring of possessive political economic power. And it may be why the Chronicles account says that Satan tempted David to do it. After taking his count, David's heart smote him, and he repents of his sin. Well, speaking about temptations and the drama of desire, I want now to turn more specifically to the in-principled account that we get in Genesis 1 to 11. And somehow I said 1 to 10 in giving you my title. I seem to have left out 11 in a kind of Freudian slip. That tower into the heavens will turn out to be significant at the end of this lecture. But we begin with the snake. The Bible is full of temptation stories, so it's not surprising to find it in one of our first governing texts, in which the temptation itself seems linked to the fact that human beings are made in God's image and thus seek to be like God. Temptation, it seems, is built right into our person. And the whole biblical drama could be read under this paradigm. We are being tested either by God or by the adversary, Satan, the prosecuting attorney in the heavenly court who wanders incessantly to and fro upon the earth to prosecute justice cases in the book of Job. And God seems often enough to hand humans over to his power. One of Augustine's favorite quotations is taken from the book of Job. Is not human life a temptation on this earth? It isn't always clear who is doing the tempting. Perhaps the second most famous temptation story in Genesis is where God tempts Abraham in Genesis 22. Sometimes it's translated testing. It's the same word. Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and offer him there as a sacrifice, a story whose scandal factor has not diminished in all the years that people have wrestled with it. Also in Exodus 20, at the Sinai scene where the law is being given by God in the covenant enactment amidst dramatic thunder and lightning, Moses says to the people, "Don't be afraid. God has come to tempt you, that the fear of God may be before your eyes, that you may not sin." Is this a joke? Oscar Wilde's quip seems right on the money. I can resist everything except temptation. I mean, the final summing commandment in the Decalogue basically says, you shall not desire. Read it. Paul famously wrestles with the seeming perversity of this whole setup in Romans 7 when he notes that human passions are desire for things to possess, to have, epithumia in the Greek, libido in the Latin, that is given energy. It's energized by the law. If it hadn't been for the law, I wouldn't have known sinful desire. I wouldn't have come to know myself and the world erotically at the level of desire. Well, maybe we're beginning to get a sense of the complexity of the topic. And Jesus only ramps it up at the level of desire. In his reinterpretation of the law, which we're going to look at more closely tonight, he says, "You've heard it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say, everyone who looks at someone lustfully has already committed adultery in the heart. If your right eye scandalizes you, pluck it out, throw it away." And just a little sidebar. I've always been interested in which of Jesus' sayings we want to take literally or moralistically in the church. We don't really expect people to pluck out their eyes or cut off their hands. Maybe we've even counseled them against it. But the teaching on divorce we want to enforce with absolute moral rigor. And there are reasons for that. There are also reasons for the hard language about plucking out eyes and cutting off limbs. But I want to get back to the book of beginnings and note that the harshness of that language has to do with the desire question. Kenneth Burke makes the nice remark about the dramatic ordering of the Genesis story. He says, "To say that Adam didn't have to sin would be like saying Oedipus didn't have to kill his father and sleep with his mother, except that in Adam's case it looks like more of a choice." What does Burke mean by that? I think he means that in the terms of the creation narratives of Genesis, Adam and Eve's actions seem determined by terms of drama. It's a delimiting, not a denial of human freedom. And it's important to look at that delimiting in terms of understanding what freedom might mean. Here the exegetical and theological opportunities are virtually endless. But I want to focus on erotics because that's, after all, the title of this lecture. Eros is not the same thing as sex, but of course it is related. While in the first creation narrative, God creates male and female and tells them to multiply and fill the earth, this implies sexual procreation, but it's not a very erotic drama in that chapter. But that changes in the second narrative, which is a very eye-opening indeed. The whole drama of the serpent in the lovely garden with exotic trees and a naked couple is unmistakably erotic, bristling with suspense and desire, complete with license, you may eat freely of every tree, accompanied immediately by a prohibition, but not the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Such an intriguing tree. If money doesn't grow on trees in the Bible, morality certainly seems to. But nothing really gets going until God says, it is not good for Adam to be alone. And after the parade of animals that we heard about, those animals to be named, Adam gets a very good Matashlop. See, I was born in southern Manitoba. I can still speak that language. Most of you probably don't even know what that word means. Oh, you do. That's good. It means afternoon nap. Have none of you read the novel by David Elias, Sunday Afternoon? He'll tell you about Matashlop. Adam gets one in Genesis. And when he wakes up to that surprising new creature, so like and yet so unlike him, we get our first full and quite enthusiastic sentence from our earthy man. This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Therefore, says the narrator, a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife, and they become one flesh. What you have is a marriage right at the beginning, a socio-erotic union, an oikos, a household, which is the first half of our word for economy, which brings together oikos and nomos, household and law, broadly defined. And, the narrator continues, the man and the woman were both naked and were not ashamed. Again, we have a kind of license, naked, and a narrative negation, almost a kind of prohibition, not ashamed. How tantalizing. Believe me, Augustine couldn't resist writing many shamelessly unerotic and yet strangely hyper-erotically self-conscious words about this state physiologically. How the pre-fall Adam would have planted his seed in the pre-fall Eve without breaking a sweat, with complete equanimity and willpower, and even with everyone watching. Though, of course, there weren't many people to watch in Eden, I guess. Only God. Which might have been enough to kill any Mennonite erotic inclination. Unless you're an atheistic Mennonite. And then let the ironic jokes begin. Maybe atheistic Mennonites are onto something. But we're getting way ahead of ourselves. Onto the scene slithers the serpent, or maybe doesn't slither yet, but certainly speaks in a very cunning manner. The Hebrew word for serpent is nachash, meaning shiny or enchanting, and the Hebrew word for cunning, arum, echoes and puns on the word for naked, arumim. We don't have the time, unfortunately, to attend to the beguiling subtlety of that conversation, but I see Gordon Maddy sitting there who can take you through it. What I want to focus on is the temptation to God-likeness by eating the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The woman sees that tree is good for food. 1 John 2 calls this the desire or the lust of the flesh. She sees that it is a delight to the eye. 1 John 2 calls this a desire or lust of the eye. And to be desired for its knowledge, which 1 John calls the pride of life. That's why you're all here, right? In a university. So she eats. She gives some to her man, and he eats in socio-erotic communion. Why is desire represented here as an act of eating? I suggest it has something to do with the biblical understanding of person. Genesis 2:7 describes God forming Adam from the dust of the ground and breathing into his nostrils the breath of life, so he becomes a living nephesh, sometimes translated soul. The soul is not something you have, it's something you are. Not a what, but a who. And this human being is always already a being joined to others, especially to the shared breath of life that is at once divine and animates all created, embodied, and fleshed reality. Biblical language of nefesh, soul, is related also to the throat or the mouth, I'm told, both to the intake of breath and to physical sustenance, the mouth, the throat being that organ of desire and also of speech. Hungry and thirsty, their nefesh fainted within them, says the psalmist. And this may only be satisfied by divine gift. God satisfies the thirsty nefesh and fills the hungry nefesh with good things. The soul is connected not only with creation, but also procreation, the striving to be fruitfully related to the ordering of creation as the ordering of love. It's no accident that the living nefesh Adam may only be completed by a partner to whom he is joined, nor is it accidental, I think, that God's covenant relation to the people is imaged in graphic sexual terms in the Bible. Yet the Bible, and I would call those erotic terms, I mean, sexual language comes into it symbolically. The eros is primary. Yet the Bible is utterly clear-sighted about the disordering of desire ever couching at this threshold of relations. The lust to dominate, possess, control, consume for myself, what is really a divine gift to be shared. So in Genesis 34, the sexual crime against Dinah, the daughter of Jacob and Leah, by the prince of Shechem, is evocatively depicted this way. He saw her, the eye, he seized her and lay with her and violated her, and his nephesh was drawn to her, but in a possessive manner that elicits violent revenge by her brothers. So also the infidelities of the people to the covenant God, described as whoring and a harlotry that ruins the people and the land through undisciplined, unjust grasping that destroys both spiritually and physically alike. So we see in this biblical imagination of soul and sexuality the wide web of dramatic relations entailed in this most intimate language. The blood is the nephesh, says the Deuteronomist, which is why Cain's brother's blood cries out to God dramatically from the ground in Genesis 4. The life blood, like the life breath, is not merely a chemical soup to be analyzed, quantified, but the sacred and mysterious life force that binds humans together in sacramental consanguinity in relation to the divine creator through a material spiritual ordering of desire and covenant communal responsibility. Not only is the relationship between Adam and Eve erotic, but this reflects the passionate erotic relationship between God and the world, which is also prominent in the prophets who express the divine passion for justice, including economic justice, in highly intimate terms. The Bible proceeds from the intimacy of the divine-human relationship and the human-to-human relationship in oikos, the household, as the basis for interpreting the broader socioeconomic and political ordering. The nomos, the law, is related to the oikos, the household, from the very beginning. An understanding of desire is crucial to this. What do Adam and Eve, getting back to the narrative, what do Adam and Eve have their eyes open to when they eat that fruit? Not God-likeness exactly, but rather a knowledge of their nakedness linked to a knowledge of good and evil, a self-awareness that induces both fear and hiding, both hiding their nakedness from each other, clothing, and hiding from God's presence in the garden. Here again, there is a freedom, they now know good and evil, and a negation, a starkness and sovereign power in possessing this kind of knowledge that is both frightening and shameful. It's perhaps not accidental that the first fruit of their erotic union, which of course in the biblical language is also a knowing, is named Cain, from the Hebrew word kana, to possess. Augustine makes a lot of this in reflecting on the fact that Cain becomes the founder of the earthly city after murdering his brother in an act of jealous rivalry that displays the tragic character of the fallen oikos, the fallen household. No longer a kinship of mutual love, but violent division rooted in the desire to possess. We might note that here again a religious motive is found in the sacred economy of making an offering to God, and it's linked to a power motive in a socio-political economy. Indeed, some commentators speculate on whether God is showing preference here in the two offerings for meat over vegetables, right? One's a farmer, one's a gatherer. A shepherding life over farming. I don't know how we could possibly know that. And I think part of the problem in the text is a presumptive knowing on Cain's part that God addresses in the fallen face of Cain's anger. Even before he commits a crime, he's angry because he thinks his offering's been refused. This is what God says: if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is couching at the door. Its desire is for you. So we have here another temptation story. If you do well, and what is that? My point is that the paradigmatic act of political founding in Genesis, as in the Roman Empire story of the founding of Rome by Romulus, is rooted in fratricide. The city and its economy is rooted from the get-go in the desire to possess and the attendant fear, greed, envy, domination, and violence that goes along with the progressive development of the arts and crafts that make urban economies so attractive. Now we must hasten to Babel, the paradigmatic city that derives from this founding, linked as it is to Babylon, the great empire to which the people of Israel eventually get taken in political and economic exile. This city is rooted in the desire to possess godlikeness and the infinity of desire in order to make a name for ourselves lest we be scattered. I do have this text. I think I have it. Let me see if I have it. No, I don't have it yet. Let me keep going. There we go. But that's not the image I want. One more. There we go. That's Genesis 11. Rooted in the desire to possess godlikeness and the infinity of desire to make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered. And we note how the divine act of creation is mimicked when they keep saying, let us make for ourselves a city. What is made out of the earth here, however, is not a human being, the way God does, though we're doing our damnedest in our culture to replicate that act of creation in our own empire. But in this one, it's rather bricks that are made out of the earth with which to build a tower into heaven. In the biblical myth of scattering, galut, in Genesis 11, the creation mandate to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth is restated polemically against an imperial Tower of Babel interpretation of that. The reduction of culture to a single language, a univocal naming of reality in order to make a name for ourselves, is depicted as being against the Creator's intention in making human beings in the divine image. Contrary to what many religious imperialists have done with it, the Bible does not oppose, but celebrates diversity, plurality, as the gift of creation. The monolithic, monolinguistic structures of efficiency in communities that seek to colonize global resources and cultures so as to enact a civic vision of world historical greatness are depicted here as a parody of creation's play of radical diversity. I want to now show you another image of Peter Bruegel, Tower of Babel. It's quite an evocative painting. It depicts this grotesque distortion with insight. Like Hobbes's Leviathan, I'm going to show you in a minute, his Romanesque tower dwarfs the natural landscape with ant-like humans working like slaves in the midst of it, on its completion, even as the tower itself is already crumbling and falling to pieces. It's an aesthetic disaster, and above all, it is totally uninhabitable, an inhumane and an unnatural political abstraction. As the political scene in the front corner depicts, if you can see it, it's not showing up very well, you've got a political group at the front, very, very small. But Bruegel is making a critical observation about the model of secular sovereignty that is underlying at his time the Holy Roman Empire of medieval Christendom as another form of Babel building. And we're going to return to that one in Lecture 3. But I want to show you now another image, this one by the father of modern secular political economy, Thomas Hobbes. He wrote a book called Leviathan, which he claimed would provide a definitive account of the motivations, the constitutive principles, and the practical requirements of political order and natural justice. He says it will be founded on the only science that it has pleased God hitherto to bestow on humankind, namely Euclidean geometry, a form of calculation. The key to scientific order is correct speech, the accurate, representational, abstract definition of real things and their causal connection in a deductive logic. This method is superior to traditional thought, he says, because it assumes no spiritual causality. It's not hung up by these traditional primitive dramas, by which the soul is somehow ordered towards a transcendent good beyond being. Hobbes's Euclidean reason in Leviathan makes two crucial assumptions. First, all causality, and therefore all motion, all motivation, is related to what is externally visible and material. And secondly, God is by nature incomprehensible. He says there is no human idea of God answerable to God's nature. There is no spiritual end in nature toward which human passions are oriented and by which they are ordered. Happiness itself, he says, is a continual process of the desire from one object to another. And human reasoning is nothing but the external calculation of motion. For individuals, a calculation of self-interest, how to guarantee the greatest freedom of external motion in order to acquire the external objects of desire and to avoid the greatest threat to that motion, namely physical death. Do you see how the process of turning things inside out is being manifest in one of the most important texts of modern politics? So it comes as no surprise that when Hobbes interprets politics as the human being writ large, he depicts the Commonwealth as a gigantic artificial human, mechanistically and technologically constructed. The mechanistic animal, if you read the book, it's that way. The mechanistic animal, it's only a human by legal fiction, is imaged poetically by Hobbes in that most obscure yet fascinating of biblical figures, the great Leviathan of Job 41. Well, we might consider this to be a strange choice of images, a very dramatic one, by one so concerned about geometric precision in terms of the new political science. But Hobbes did. He had that image artistically engraved on the frontispiece of the first public edition of the Leviathan, apparently with his own face depicted on its head. He was not a modest man. Leviathan stands for the artificial soul that governs the artificial body politic, and it is name given to the sovereign power worthy of worship that publicly represents the conventional order of the modern commonwealth and its contractual justice. This Leviathan is both beast and man. The Latin inscription superimposed above that image, I'm not sure if you can see it, above that gigantic figure with a scaled body that's comprised of all the contracted citizens, they're contractually joined in the body of Leviathan, that now rises imperiously above the artificially reduced natural landscape, like the tower does, That text reads, "Non est potestas super terram quae comparator." No one on earth may be compared with him. Underneath it, this is the frontispiece, you see that the institutions, the two dominant institutions of his time, the church and the state, are brought together underneath the authority of the Leviathan, with the sword on the one hand, the bishop's crozier, the power of the state, on the other, in a unified state that will prove successful. Well, in Genesis 11, to return to that, the divine scattering through linguistic confusion is viewed as an act of mercy that restores the possibility of shalom through diverse local communities of scale. I said before, the Bible is not simply anti-urban or anti-technological, nor does it try to destroy or refuse to engage empire civilizations. And I want to close with this. But it engages those empire civilizations through scattering, galut. The Greek word is diaspora. A significant biblical text pertaining to the diaspora paradigm is found in Jeremiah 29, where the prophet is giving divine advice to those being taken into Babylonian exile. Here again, the scattering by the people is interpreted as a good, so long as they can remain focused on the creation mandate. Be fruitful and multiply, set down roots, build houses, plant gardens, intermarry in a foreign land, build community amidst differences, and above all, seek the shalom, the well-being, flourishing, of the empire city into which you are being sent, for in its shalom you will find your shalom. I suggest this is neither advocacy for the empire ethos of Babylon, its political tyranny, its economic expansionist exploitation, its monolithic colonization of other cultures, but nor is it a call to create a separatist community of religious and cultural purity and isolation. Rather, the people are called to live out of their alternative economy, even where the homeland is alien, even where they are not in control institutionally, numerically, or even spiritually. A diaspora ethic of shalom, then, is a public ethic that is neither isolationist separatism nor complacent accommodation to tyranny. Babylon and empire do not define the terms. The people need to live out of a moral orientation, nevertheless, toward a shalom that is shared with the empire city. It's a personal and economic ethic of community dwelling that entails respect for local cultures, learns the languages of the other in order to communicate about that shared good. It will not impose a single language or a monolithic vision of the good upon everyone. Diaspora Jews in exile, tellingly, became expert translators and cross-cultural communicators who were linguistically and culturally creative, not focused upon the conservative preservation of a single system or set of institutions, nor even for struggles for civil sovereignty. Rather, the vocation of this public ethic was one of cultural and social responsibility in the everyday. We could call it quotidian ethics, not the heroic quest for transcultural, globalizing idealism or world domination in an end of history fantasy. Indeed, history itself, as the Bible displays, is viewed as collections of particular and diverse narratives in various languages with a variety of genres, approaches, and traditions that foster open engagement. We could call it intertextuality, the creative play of plurality, rather than a single overarching cultural linguistic system that homogenizes meaning and seeks to control its production and distribution. I think I'm out of time. And besides, I think it's time for you to ask some questions and for this to go into a more exchange mode than a lecture mode. I'm going to stop right there. I will say this, I think this community is going to require characteristics that that require the education, the re-education of desire, and the next two lectures are going to be looking at that process. in dramatic terms. Okay.
Well, thank you very much. As has been suggested, we're going to open the floor for discussion, and I'm going to ask you to pose your questions from one of the two microphones up here. If you don't mind, just introduce yourself before you submit your penetrating and insightful questions. Dr. Cricker has agreed to simply field those himself. So please, we have some time here.
My name is Gord Zerbe. Thanks, Travis, for a delightful first lecture. You've whet the appetite. We'll be back. I wanted to follow up on the last imagery of Babylon as location and place relative to Leviathan and where then we exist. And it has all kinds of interesting possibilities with the scattering as healing, et cetera. And there's just opened up all kinds of possibilities. The one thing I might want to sort of comment on and ask your response is, in one sense, you located the people then as exiles in Babylon. But actually, the first narrative of Genesis 12 is that the people are exiles out of the area that Babylon controls with the Abrahamic exodus. And it seems to me that we first have an Abrahamic exodus, then we have the Mosaic exodus, and they're parallel, although we don't think of the Abrahamic one as an exodus. In that connection, the end of the biblical story is also a call to exit out of Babylon, but in a curious kind of way. It assumes we're still located there, and yet still some sort of alternative within that. And I just wanted to, there's all kinds of points of potential exploration.
So say more, like, I mean, where would you like to go with that in terms of what we've been doing here?
Because the dialectic, I mean, your comment that we're not being called to the alternative escape. You push a Mennonite buttons. On the other hand, we're to do the shalom of the city. This sort of this duality of existence, and maybe to sort of follow a bit on that.
Yeah, see, one of the points that I would make is that empire can also be wilderness. And I'm going to make that point in the third lecture, I think. So in other words, I'm using metaphors to talk about place. But the experience can be had in a variety of ways, in a variety of places. The point is not to separate them into exclusive antinomies. Part of the point is to do that. I mean, I'm suggesting that the desire for Babel-like domination in a monolinguistic, homogenizing empire is the wrong thing. But of course, no empire of that sort is ever successful in doing it, which is a mercy. If ever, I would want to argue, if ever we were successful in doing that, we would be successful in creating hell on earth. I mean, that's part of the point of these critiques. But if we believe in a merciful God, we also believe that that may not be humanly possible. But I'm going to be playing with those contrasts throughout, and so I'd be interested in any of your thoughts about, you know, particularly the thing that I've been presenting. It's not the only possible way to present it, I realize. And I'm going to learn narratives in the biblical text and how they may, you know, show up points of nuance or difference. I'm going to say some more about, you know, the whole Mosaic Exodus and the notion of taking over and possessing a land, which has also been used as a biblical narrative for all manner of colonization, also in the modern world. And it's a story of freedom, liberation. Well, as I've suggested with Language of Temptation, there are deep ambiguities here that require our personal engagement. They are not to be sorted out simply through a code kind of ethic. They can't be, right? Okay. More questions, or criticisms? I mean, yeah, or follow-ups.
In respect to your last one about the other exodus to get land, in one sense, the Genesis 2, 12 story is that the land experience of Abraham is the first diaspora. Which is a tricky thing to then to say to our Jewish colleagues, but it presents all kinds of dilemmas for thinking of that as well.
Right, that's great. Yeah.
My name is Chris Huebner. I teach theology and philosophy here at CMU, and I don't think this mic is on. I can wait.
You want to use this one?
Maybe I'll go over to that one.
Oh, well, you'll start lecturing if he goes here.
You don't want me up there. This isn't so much a question as an invitation to say a little bit more, and in particular in the way in which you're weaving together images of desire and images of knowing, knowledge, throughout this. I mean, it strikes me that the Hobbesian imagination of the secular state parallels the creation of the modern university. We're here in a university that is aware of its oddness, strangeness relative to the modern secular university. I wonder if you might say a little bit more about how this possessive form of desire exists within the context of the city that we call the university, and how a diasporic way of knowing might look different.
Yeah, that's a great question, I mean, and a complicated one. But I mean,
I'm not asking for an answer. I get
you. Yeah, this will be just a little reflection on that as an opportunity. I mean, the university might be a problem. So one of the reasons why we inhabit a university is because we believe that there are connections to all disciplines in a knowledge that should be brought together, or in a way of knowing that we want brought together, and that's certainly an important impetus. However, when the university becomes dominated and controlled by a single language that then will define what is legitimate knowledge and illegitimate knowledge, good knowledge and bad knowledge, when that becomes too homogenized, we want maybe to be calling for a multiversity yet again. But we are now inhabiting in our own time, I think, a multiversity that finds it very difficult to communicate as an oikos, a community, a household of knowledges, about what's important, about why we're getting to know what we do know. I think, and of course, there are many temptations that are implicit in all of this, no less than, I mean, we're knowing creatures. Right? You know, you couldn't even have this exchange in the garden without there being some form of language and knowing. Right? So the question of, this is why I said it's built into our nature. The problems seem built in to our personhood in the form of the opportunity for there to be forms of control and possession that move us in problematic directions. Certainly they're pervasive in the university. And I mean, just to name a parallel to Hobbes within the context of the modern university project, you know, one of the famous fathers of the father modern university is Francis Bacon, who gave us the slogan, knowledge is power. And what did he mean by knowledge is power? We like to quote that term. Well, it's power, he said, to put nature to the rack and compel her to answer our questions. These guys were good because they still speak in images. And the images are worth paying attention to. It's an image of torture, virtually, of suggesting that we will dominate and exploit the goods of nature in order to meet our desires and our needs for being liberated from her constraints. Well, is that even possible? Is that even desirable? Well, as we know, we need nature. We are nature. And so to get carried away with this view that through our knowledges we can become free of its constraints through a power that is now godlike in our hands, because we have the tools now in the language of modern science and calculation, experimental, and so on, it's as bad as religious language. I mean, religious language also gives us power to engage in domination, right? When it's used as if we know what we possess here and we can impose it as the good news that everyone must accept. That's what I would call a non-erotic understanding of what missions looks like. And it's not good. But we are a very good missionizing culture in the secular West. We are great colonialists with our language of economic power, technology, human rights, and so on. And it's worth paying attention to those secular equivalents of a problematic kind of of knowing as domination. I don't know, you gave me too much opportunity.
Gerald Entz. I guess I'm quite sympathetic to your critique of disordered desire, when desire becomes possessive, when we think that the good life is to make our own future, to seize ourselves, seize the world, and make our own future. I'm also, even while very sympathetic, I worry about how, I often think about how that sort of self-empowering rhetoric, how empowering that make your own future rhetoric can be, and how on the converse, this accusations of disordered desire are so often used to limit emancipation and to reenact forms of colonialism to enforce the status quo. And just to sort of, I guess, pick up on that a little bit more, it was striking to me how often in your lecture it was women who would fall prey to this disordered desire. You know, it's the females on campus who are too slutty. It's the when Israel is unfaithful, then she is a whore. Goes on.
Yeah.
So I guess this is also, I mean, you've only said one third of what you're going to say, and I expect constructive efforts will come. But
yeah,
just to speak to where is emancipation? I guess
I'll just say this. I hope you didn't hear me saying that it's only women that are this or that.
No, but, I didn't hear you say that. I did hear implications.
But do you think that the women would be any more affirmed by the way I began this lecture?
No, I just think that
I'm sorry if I did offend people, but I'm not intending to type this. However, we have an inherited set of traditions that bring with it their own problems in terms of language. But to shy away from those problems, I think, is problematic. In other words, I don't think we're going to find a neutral discourse in which to engage those questions. And then it's a question of being attentive to the metaphors we continue to use and what metaphors people are claiming to find liberating or empowering, right? And to examine them critically. So, but I'd be interested if at certain points in the way that I've used the language, you found it problematic, because that's really interesting.
Yeah? I mean, I guess we're running out of time.
But, no, that's okay.
I was impressed with how you navigated that language without stating explicitly. It's just after a while, the examples and where they always seem to lie. You know, it seems to be always the oppressed groups who don't get desire. Meanwhile, we colonizers, we are the ones who know how to, we will properly reorder desire so that it is properly.
Yeah, but I think Wendell Berry, for example, in that comment is suggesting it goes in every direction. People that think they're getting what they want, or they think they're getting freedom, or they're getting power, or they're getting the goods, are deluded.
Right? I agree. Yeah.
And that we therefore all need to be aware of how that works, right? That's what it would mean to be an oikos, a household where things are characterized by an alternative kind of intimacy as well as an alternative kind of set of relations. All right.
Hi, my name is Melanie Campin. I don't know if it's a comment or a question. Maybe you can speak to it a little bit. I feel like it's very easy for us as Mennonites to narrate our story as one of being scattered from Europe, from Prussia. And then we come to Canada and we live here as a diasporic people, sort of, differently amidst the empire that is Canada. And I think that we like to do that. And it's a very sort of nice self-image. But I think that narrative risks failing to see how that very diasporic narrative that wants to undermine the imperial thrust is actually bound up with colonialism itself on this indigenous land.
Mm-hmm. No question.
So how do you navigate that?
Mm-hmm. I think it has to be navigated. I'm going to say something about that tonight.
Okay.
but not to put this off, but that's absolutely correct. And certainly you can't speak in a monolithic way about the Mennonites, right? Mennonites are all over the map, and then it's important to contextualize. What are the specifics about those interstitial relations between indigenous peoples and colonizing peoples? The Mennonites come at the invitation of a government. They are happy to flee a place where they can't do that, and what do you know? They're taking over land that's been taken over. And how do you come to terms with that legacy? There's no way around it, in my view. There's no way around that anywhere, I think. If you take this biblical vision of things, you can't start from a pure place. It's not possible. So we all have to begin, I think, with a recognition we're not pure, and then ask, what is it that we're doing, and how might we reshape it in ways that aren't so problematic as they've come to be, right? And I don't think we can do this in terms of grand solutions. They require hard work, getting to know the neighbor, getting to know what that story is in which I dwell, that I inhabit even unknowingly, so that I can make a change in both my order of desire, but that's in keeping with an order of knowing. Because I'm not saying knowing is bad, but it requires more than what I would call a moralistic knowing. Here's the good guys, here's the bad guys, here's the good thing. It's more complicated usually. And theology helps us sort out that complexity by not going to a moralizing discourse right away, right? It means contextualizing in, I think, a more complex manner that is helping us to see that. In order to make some of these changes. But it's a very good point.
Thank you.
Last question, okay?
I've lost my voice, so if you can't hear me, I'm sorry. But I want to say this right, so I'm just going to read it.
Sure.
As I've hashed my question out here. Hmm. You propose this diametric comparison between a vibrant, full life of erotics that are in keeping with the creation mandate and intimacy with God and others, and those that are not. That is, between desire that's non-possessive and respectful and honoring, and the kinds of desires that are characteristic of our fallen state, jealous, possessive, homogenizing ones. And I'm wondering, am I correct in getting the impression that hubris is at the root of our difficulty with erotic desire as it's meant to be?
That's certainly a big one, right? I mean, the hubris that oversteps by wanting myself to have what it desires, right? Is that what you're getting at? The notion of an overreaching that puts the desire at the center of myself.
Yeah, and I think looking an overreaching out, yeah. and even a conceit, I think, and that pertains to the homogenizing effect that we understand, that, you know,
sure.
It pertains to ethnocentrism even, and it makes us want to reduce the possibilities within a diverse world to what we understand.
Right. Okay, that's very good. I mean, a lot of superstitious behavior in the world, and I'm going to call it that because it's not just religious behavior, it's technological behavior, all kinds of behavior, is behavior that wants to control the world, make it available to my manipulation, so that and that is a kind of hubris that believes that the world can be so, that the world is so ordered that I can put myself at the center of a fantasy and live it out in any way that I could. You know, if that's the fantasy of what fulfillment and happiness and freedom look like, I said before, that would be a hell on earth. We would live as isolated creatures, right? And when I talk about the aliveness of intimacy, I mean the shared intimacy of our life that is shared in all of the complexity of that sharing. But it's done in proximity to others, in shared reflection upon our shared desires, but also the mutual engagement of that calls me into question every time I do it. And I think that's why, you know, the third lecture is so important for me in this, and that's liturgics. You know, what kinds of practices start to habituate the attitudes we need to engage the world that way, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. That's helpful.
Well, thank you very much for your participation and heartfelt gratitude for this fine presentation. These lectures are difficult in that you're forced to confront yourself and change your life if you pay attention.